afraid this talk doesn't have much to do with cosmology, but something I've gotten interested in the last couple of years. And that is the black hole information paradox and firewalls and all this business that's been all over archive in the last couple of years. So what I'm going to do is start by just reviewing some of the old results, semi-classical results for the expectation value of the quantum energy momentum tensor and its virtual background in the inner vacuum. And particularly, I think what I want to emphasize here is physical interpretation and conformal anomalies. That's the base, you know, and try to, you know, talk a bit about what we can learn from these old results, which I think hasn't been appreciated sufficiently by a lot of the people in the field. Now, then I'm going to review the information paradox, which is a paradox basically between unitarity and locality of quantum field theory. Make a bit of a critique of some of the more common attempts to resolve this in the literature, but certainly not. It's going to be a very limited view if I try to talk about all the different proposals. It would take several hours, but. But what I do agree is that there is some need for new physics by the page time. So the case for what I'm going to argue is that what I see is at least the simplest way of resolving this is to and least does at least the least violence to sort of establish principles of quantum field theory is that there is enhanced quantum back reaction beyond what is what the semi-classical results indicate, and I'll give some arguments why I believe this is not unreasonable, and a lot of them based most strongly on this Husserl-Couverin entropy bound, and then I'll give a sort of explicit sort of toy model scenario, which is just postulating a metric which does what I wanted to do, and so it's is definitely a toy model, not something serious resulting from the real calculation. Now. And then talk about possible endpoints of the evaporation. Which basically amounts to either that the quantum back reaction just gets rid of the trapped surfaces because there is no event horizon, and all the trapped information inside the black hole escapes around the page time. And the other possibility, which in some ways is less attractive, but is that there's a large remnant with zero Hawking temperature, which is just sits there, not radiating any more Hawking radiation. So it's there's no problem with firewalls and so on, but it does. Have some questions concerning whether about unitarity certainly in that possible endpoint, and then I'll conclude with some final thoughts and just some general framing of the black hole evolution and thoughts about what entropy means in the context of black holes and so on. Okay, so I'm going to assume spherical symmetry, keep things simple, and so R is my 4 pi R squared is the area of a two-sphere, and an asymptotically flat space-time. Now I'm going to, for the particle theorists, I'm going to make them uncomfortable by using GR units, G equals C equal one. And I'll explicitly, instead of saying H bar equal to one, I'm going to set H bar equal to, especially in terms of the square of the Planck mass in with G equals C equal one. So everything has unit, you know, mass, length, time, are all the same units. And considering only very large black holes, so I definitely want to, you know, keep things sort of as semi-classical as possible. So I'm considering something like, say, a solar mass black hole or several solar mass black holes, for instance, which of course, or, well, at least certainly huge compared to, very large compared to the Planck mass. And I'm also only considering black holes formed by gravitational collapse from some sort of essentially Minkowski initial vacuum. So so we have, and I'll assume a pure state in the initially before the black hole is formed, and then again, just a reminder in these units, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is given by this formula. And 4 pi m over np squared. So the point is the ratio of the Planck mass to the mass of the black hole is squared is a natural expansion parameter in a semi-classical picture. And it's since m over p squared is of the order 10 to the 77, the semi-classical expansion should, on the face of it at least, be extraordinarily good. I mean, the expansion parameter is 10 to the minus 77. Then the Hawking temperature under is equal to the surface gravity times np squared over 2 pi, and surface gravity is 1 over 4 m for a Schwarzschild black hole. And then again, the Stefan-Boltzmann constant, which I'll use in just presenting the results, is given by that. So, okay, so what about the semi-classical energy momentum tensor? Well, so as a result of work by various people in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s, there are both analytic estimates and numerical results for massless fields, in particular massless scalar and electromagnetic fields on a Schwarzschild background for the energy momentum tensor outside the event horizon, which is that article 2m, or the horizon. By the way, I'm not assuming the existence of event horizon, so when I just say horizon, I don't mean event horizon. I mean typically an apparent horizon. And but in the case of semi-classical approximation, the Schwarzschild background, of course, they're the same. The event horizon is an apparent horizon, the Schwarzschild. Now, okay, so now the spherical symmetry only allows four independent components of the energy momentum tensor, an energy density, and in a static frame, the outside the black hole, is there an energy density, an energy flux, a radial stress, and a transverse stress related to the coordinate in Schwarzschild coordinates, the standard Schwarzschild coordinates to the coordinate components as shown there. Now, important aid to deriving the semi-classical result are the conservation equations. The sensor should satisfy covariant divergence equal to zero, and as is typically assumed in the for the exterior, that since the evolution of the black holes and time scale is enormously long compared to the dynamical time scale, that is usually assumed that that everything is stationary outside the horizon, and that means then that the conservation equations have this simple form, where this is the conservation of energy, just the divergence of the flux equal to zero, and then we have conservation momentum, which is the relationship between, well, I think it was the relationship between the radial stress and the transverse stress. Now, furthermore, in the standard semi-classical approximation, there's a conformal anomaly, and the trace of the energy momentum tensor is given just by this conformal anomaly. And that is a state-independent expression in terms of the curvature of the background space-time. In the case of Schwarzschild, it's only the square of the Weyl tensor that comes in, and it's equal to this 48 m squared over r to the 6th. And these coefficients depend on the spin of the field. And so for a massive scalar field, it's 1. For electromagnetic field, taking into account there are two polarizations, it's minus 13. And then for the gravitons, or spin 2 field, or in other words, gravitons, it's 212. Okay, so now, as I said, I'm assuming the Underwood vacuum, which basically says that there's no incoming radiation at past null infinity. Furthermore, that on the future horizon of the black hole, the energy momentum tensor is regular. And essentially, this is well-known arguments that this is what you expect. Once things have settled down after initial collapse, this should describe the fields of a black hole. The evolution from the Underwood vacuum should be what applies in the case of a black hole formed by gravitational collapse, as opposed to an internal black hole. So then the semi-classical calculation, the calculations first done by Page in the 70s, you can calculate the energy flux, well, at infinity, but because of the conservation law, once you know it at infinity, you know it everywhere. It's a function of radius. And there's a coefficient k sub s, again, spin dependent, which, as opposed to the conformal anomaly, which the coefficients got bigger with increasing spin, these get smaller. And the standard explanation of that is that it's harder to get for the modes to propagate through the potential barrier in the mode equations outside the event horizon around Oracle 3M. And that's easiest to do for S waves, but only spin zero, therefore, can get out more easily than spin one or spin two. Now, because the height of the barrier depends on the angular momentum of the waves. Okay, so now here's where I make somewhat of a departure from the standard presentation of these semi-classical results. I'm not obtaining any new results, but just analyzing them in a somewhat different way. And what I do is split up the energy momentum tensor into an outgoing null fluid, an ingoing null fluid, and a traceless sort of residual in that reference I gave the archive paper. I call this vacuum polarization, but that's not really the right term. It's sort of corrections to the fact that things aren't really propagating purely in the radial direction, largely. I mean, but then finally, there's a piece associated with the trace. And the particular form I choose, well, for the transverse stress, for instance, of this energy momentum tensor, this component of the energy momentum tensor associated with the trace, is because the trace goes with 1 over r to the 6th, and it turns out that this form automatically satisfies the, given that the trace goes with 1 over r to the 6th, all these terms goes with 1 over r to the 6th, this satisfies the momentum conservation equation automatically, and therefore the overall conservation momentum tensor, this is conserved separately, and the sum of these three is conserved, but not these individual ones. But not the first three individually. Okay, so now, taking into account the boundary conditions, we want regularity at infinity and the future horizon. And I'm we're going to write this everything in terms, you know, use X as a convenient variable to express things, 2m over r, so x equal 1 on the horizon, then it, the there's sort of an, this one unknown function basically in the semi-classical, given all the constraints from the symmetry and so on, is the basically, well, you can think of it as the fraction of the net energy flux that's ingoing. I call it f sub s of x. And of course, far outside the black hole, everything's outgoing, it's just the Hawking radiation. And so f sub s would be zero at infinity. But on the horizon, regularly in the horizon requires that f sub equal 1 on the horizon. And so 1 minus f sub s is, to take all this into account, has to have this form where h sub s is a free function which is finite both at infinity and on the horizon. So it's some smooth function which is regular both at infinity and the horizon. And if you look at the expansion of this, you see that it goes as 1 plus order of x cubed as x goes to 0. In other words, as r goes to infinity. And in this h sub s, basically, you have to basically determine it from, you can try to guess analytically, but numerically, it's really determined numerically from sums over all the modes of the fields. And there are calculations which have done this for spin 0 and spin 1. OK, so what are the results? Well, so I'm plotting here the f of x for spin 0 and 1. The red is spin 0. And notice that you have this, so it's 0 at x equals 0, which is r equal infinity. And around r equal 3m, which is the height of the potential barrier, it's around about a half. And then inside, closer to the horizon, it's the f is you know, gets closer and closer to 1. And there's this macroscopic region around the horizon, well, in which there's a substantial amount of, you know, the energy flux is dominated by negative energy flowing inward. Now, that's not something that makes any sense classically, right? That's the quantum effect. And that implies, then, that there are quantum correlations extending not just over some Planck scale around the horizon, but over delta r of order m about the horizon. And I think this is a very important point to keep in mind. Now, it's true that as you go to higher spins, things get more sharply peaked. So you have to get closer to the horizon, but it's still a macroscopic distance. Now, these curves for x greater than 1 or r less inside the horizon shouldn't believe these curves because the calculations are only valid outside the horizon. And the extrapolation inside the horizon, this is just an analytic extrapolation based on an analytic approximation formula. And that's just taking h sub s equal to a constant. Now, it turns out for spin 0, that's a quite good approximation outside the horizon to about 1%, as was shown originally by Matt Visser in the late 90s. And with C0 is equal to 0.54. Now, for spin 1, I tried to make an estimate from numerical results of Jensen, Ottewell, and McLaughlin, and Ottewell. But they presented their results in a rather crude graphs in which they sort of mixed in the conformal anomaly part of the instrument here with the rest. And so, because the conformal anomaly part for spin 1 and higher is sort of dominates over everything else, that takes up most of the, you know, the amplitude of the graph. So it's hard to pick out a value. And my best guess is something like 3.8. Now, for s equal 2, there aren't any really numerical results, at least as far as I know. And my guess is just, you know, just be going up with spins, so I boosted up by another I mean, it's the same factor going from spin 0 to spin 1, going up to spin 2. Now, and that, and so you get this dip. See, F at less than 1 means that the outgoing flux is greater than the sort of the Hawking flux, right? And so you get a negative F for the higher spins initially, and then a sharper peak going up to the event horizon. Okay. Now, as I said, you know, in the under vacuum, we want everything to be regular in the horizon. And so this is just evaluating in a freely fall, this is in a freely falling frame, of course, not in a static frame, which is singular on the horizon. And in a freely falling frame, you can, you know, calculate the, take the results and transfer from the static frame to the freely falling frame and take the limit on the horizon and calculate for each of these four components I decomposed the energy momentum tensor to calculate the value of the energy density on the horizon. Now, this is for a freely falling frame which is falling from rest at infinity. And that gives, in terms of a large outward, so the free fall means we're in the free fall frame. Now, this E residual and the E conformal anomaly, because the pressure is minus the energy density, those contributions are invariant under Lorentz transformations in the radial direction. So, so the choice of free fall frame makes no difference to these numbers, but it does strongly affect these numbers. And if you say consider a frame which free falls from just outside the horizon instead of from infinity, that would decrease the out part and increase the in part just by Lorentz, you know, boost. And so for a frame which is free falling from just outside the horizon, you could have the negative energy density of the inward flux dominate over the outward, positive outward flux. Now, okay, so again, these are just some of the key lessons I want to take from these old results. and the key point is that everything except the conformal anomaly part, you don't really, you know, what's calculated is only valid outside the horizon. But the conformal anomaly part, this is directly related to the background curvature, which you, assuming there is a Schwarzschild spacetime inside the horizon, you know what the conformal anomaly part is, and it strongly dominates, you can see, overwhelmingly, well, if you include the spin two, it overwhelmingly dominates near the horizon, and that can be extended all the way until basically the semi-classical approximation breaks down inside the horizon. Okay, so so that's results from the energy momentum tensor, and now you can use that to then calculate the first order back reaction on the metric using the, you know, the classical Einstein equations. Now, to do that, you want to use, you know, coordinates which are regular on the horizon, and the natural choice are these advanced Enneking Finkelstein coordinates in dealing with the future horizon. And so you can calculate from the components in the static frame outside the horizon, you can calculate the coordinate components in this advanced Enneking Finkelstein coordinates. And so you find, for instance, that TVV, how clear that is. Oops. So TVV here is minus 2 E out minus. So this is and minus E residual and minus E conformal anomaly. TRR is plus 2 E out minus the other two energy densities. And then TVR is just the total energy flux which proportional to total energy flux with 1 minus x. And now the energy flux in the static frame is actually infinite on the horizon, but the 1 minus x cancels at infinity, and you get a finite result, which is simply this. And and then TRV turns out to be proportional to the E out, in other words, the outward part of the net energy flux, with a 1 minus x inverse. And what that means is to get a finite TRV, you need to have E out go to zero on the horizon. That was incorporated into that expression for f of x. And for this simple analytic approximation, if we take that function h sub s of x and just set it to a constant c sub s, then this you have an explicit expression for this, which is nice and regular on the horizon. Now, to calculate the back reaction, we need a general spherically symmetric metric, and in these coordinates can be in form as this form when the inverse components. So A is the G inverse RR, and apparent horizon is by definition where the gradient of the radius, source radius, is zero, null rather, not zero, but null. And that's where A equals zero. So A equals zero is a locates at an apparent horizon, A is equal to zero, and vice versa. The Einstein equations are really very simple in these coordinates. And so you can calculate the time dependence of, well, this M, by the way, A is 1 minus 2 little m over R, right? This defines little m. And so the little m then has so the time derivative of little m is just related to the sort of overall energy flux. The radial derivative is related to this TVV, and then the gradient of radial derivative of psi, this other metric function, is to TRV, and notice that psi is zero if there is no outgoing flux, which makes things even simpler. And psi you can think of as sort of as a renormalization of the time coordinate, basically, because it comes in and multiplies, each dV is multiplied by an e to psi. Okay, so now, because if you look at the expression for the energy, the T, the R, the MDV is independent of R outside the horizon. So the exterior metric remains Schwarzschild to a very good approximation, and that implies then a slowly decreasing mass M for the background, and taking into account, so the background stays very close to Schwarzschild, but with a gradually decreasing mass. And of course, this is just the standard black hole evaporation scenario. Inside the horizon, you can notice that the conformal anomaly, so the only thing we know is the conformal anomaly, and this gives an energy density, assuming that I think, which is reasonable, that the part of the instrument, since they're associated with conformal anomaly, goes as 1 over r to the sixth, and the energy density associated with that goes as 1 over r to the sixth. And you can easily see that you get a substantial modification of this mass function m, little m, when r is less than this third root of np squared m, which is much larger than the Planck mass, because m is much bigger than the Planck mass, but very small compared to m. So now, as far as the standard semi-classical approximation goes, the Hawking radiation, which is determined by the geometry at the outer apparent horizon, or around article 2m, apparently continues, because there's no obvious reason why the semi-classical approximation So it fails deep inside the black hole, but of course that's in the causal future of anything happening on the event horizon, around the horizon. So Hawking radiation apparently continues as long as this mass is much bigger than the Planck mass. And think of the Hawking radiation as sort of a pair creation process, which you have Hawking quanta going out and then some Hawking partner quanta going in inside the black hole. Then these Hawking partners, more and more of these Hawking partners accumulate inside the black hole. And there's an entanglement entropy between the black hole interior and the Hawking radiation, which initially is small, but grows. And at the page time, by definition, this entanglement entropy equals the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And it's at the page time that all the issues about being able to restore a pure quantum state and so on, and the existence of a firewall and so on really come to a head is at the page time. Now, there's the information paradox then is that the Hawking radiation seems to be thermal. Locality apparently forbids transfer of any quantum information from inside the black hole because there are trapped surfaces and the light cones are all pointed in. And if this continues down to the Planck scale, then and the black hole evaporates completely, then pure states have evolved into mixed states, which is supposed to be forbidden by quantum mechanics. So this is not far from an exhaustive list, but some of the more prominent ways of trying to get around this paradox are, well, possibly a Planck scale remnant. In other words, instead of evaporating completely, the black hole just evaporates down to the Planck scale where the semi-classical approximation breaks down and you're just left with some sort of remnant. The problem is that if the trapped quantum information hasn't been able to escape, the entropy contained within that microscopic black hole vastly exceeds its Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, which is of order one. So you have, and that leads to various issues, and also there's the issue of if you have such objects with tiny mass, huge entropy, they should be easily produced by pair creation. And we don't see the universe dissolving into microscopic black holes. So, we need to get rid of quantum information. So one argument is that maybe we can say the Hawking radiation isn't perfectly thermal. There are subtle correlations between the Hawking quanta, which carry this quantum information out from the horizon. Now, there is an argument which I find at least reasonably convincing by Mathur, which that this doesn't work. The small corrections cannot remove the entanglement between the radiation and the black hole. But there's also the issue of how the quantum information trapped deep inside the black hole gets out, can get outside the horizon, because again, causally everything is forced inward without violating locality, which is again a very fundamental principle of quantum field theory. Now, a popular, in some quarters at least, a popular this complementarity idea is that, well, to an outside observer, he never actually sees the quantum information go inside the horizon, because he never sees anything inside the horizon, right? If there's an event horizon. So the idea then is that the quantum information from the point of view of the outside observer is stored in some sort of stretched horizon, which is maybe the order of the Planck scale thick. It's thermalized in the scrambling time, so-called fast scrambling, which is order m log m over m Planck, and which is in the order of 100 dynamical times or so, in other words, quite quickly on the page time scale. and then gradually comes out in Hawking radiation from the horizon. And now a freely falling observer, somebody who falls inside the black hole, at the same time sees the same quantum information inside the black hole. Now that would, there's a, again, a fundamental principle of quantum mechanics that, that you can't have cloning of quantum information. But the argument then is that cloning is okay as long as there's no single observer who can detect the cloning. And then there've been arguments about, well, can you really keep the information separate from both in the right way? Of course, another option is that the whole notion of space-time somehow breaks down inside the black hole horizon. And you have, instead of space-time, you have some sort of stringy fuzzball, and the math has been a prominent advocate of this picture. And problems here, well, it's hard to, since this involves drastic departures from semi-classical gravity, you know, it's a little hard, and we don't really understand quantum gravity well enough to say how. Mathur has arguments for why this is not implausible, but there are, but I, without getting into those, what I find difficult is that the horizon, location of an event horizon is not, it depends on the entire future history of the black hole. You don't really know where it is until you know, how much matter you're going to accrete, you know, some part time in the future and so on. So, now, while you do know where the apparent horizon is, the apparent horizon is space-like, all matter is being added to the black hole. So the apparent horizon has to, the event horizon, you know, sort of stays close to the event apparent horizon, but then as you're going to put in another slug of matter into the black hole, the event horizon has to start moving out to anticipate the addition of that matter, but the apparent horizon then has to suddenly jump in a space-like way. So that would seem to mean that the extent that, you know, information is propagated, the fuzzball respects the surface of the fuzzball, respects the causal properties of the space-time just outside it, that information would get lost. So, but just generally, I mean, I find it hard to believe that a really large black hole could have this sort of quantum catastrophe, because it should be very classical, or at least before the page time. Now, there are problems with all of these, I think, these standard sort of explanations or trying to get around the information paradox. Quantum information in the collapsing star, for instance, certainly I see no way that could possibly be stripped, you know, somehow put into some state on the horizon, because the quanta in the star are very high energy quanta with tiny wavelengths compared to the radius of the horizon. So they should just go right through the horizon without, or the apparent horizon or whatever, without any transfer of information. And that information then would seem to get lost, even if somehow you say that the information being generated by the Hawking radiation is somehow stored on the horizon. But also, if you look at the propagation, the outward radiological desics, just inside and just outside the horizon, they diverge away from the horizon, which would indicate any information that's on the horizon would tend to get lost either to infinity or into the black hole. And so basically the horizon is a very stable thing, and I wrote a paper in 1981 arguing this. And it really needs to seem to violate causality to get information out of the black hole. And, you know, scrambling, well, I would argue that the whole idea of scrambling is a misinterpretation of classical decay of classical hair of a black hole. And it's not thermalization, it's just losing the disturbance near the horizon, propagating away from the horizon, and the horizon settling down to a state that's just vacuum within the constraints of global conserved global charges, like the electric charge in a resonant Wilson black hole. If you need to, want to store information close to the horizon, it really takes huge energies in the freely falling frame to do that, and there's no way, there's no physical mechanism producing such huge energies. So I don't think that's possible. And also, discussion of the thermal atmosphere of the horizon, is the Unruh-Wald effect, seen by static observers, is, I would argue, and that plays some role in some of the models about how the information gets out. I would argue that this is essentially indistinguishable from a Rindler horizon Minkowski space, which carries no quantum information. And it's the property of the servers, not of the black hole. So the fact that you have this thermal atmosphere with, which as far as the static observers go, large entropy, is irrelevant as far as the, you don't certainly don't see that stress sensor being a source in the Einstein equations, and has nothing to do with the actual one-Neumann entropy of the black hole. Okay, so what's my scenario? Well, so I argue that, you know, well, first, sort of the prerequisite for my scenario is that the there cannot be a real space-time singularity at r equals zero. Because if that happens, then, for instance, the collapsing star gets absorbed into that singularity, and the singularity, by definition, means that you can't predict the future, and you've lost the unitarity right then. So, now, of course, what could happen is it's not, in the quantum field theory, it's not a, maybe a sort of classical singularity, but there could be some resolution in quantum field theory. But, and there have been arguments by the loop quantum gravity people that is not impossible. But what the resolution that I want to postulate is that what you end up with is, as a result, say, of the collapse of the star, is a non-singular core to the space-time inside the black hole, in which inside, remember I said 2 little m over r is equal 1 is an apparent horizon. If 2 m over r is less than 1, that means you're inside an inner apparent horizon. And r equals 0 is just a locally flat space-time, okay? And this requires some fairly drastic quantum back reaction, but at just in a small region around r equals 0. Now, to try to guess how that might work, I, again, rely on the conformal anomaly because, again, because it's, it seems to dominate, well, certainly at the event horizon and possibly all the way in. And if you just take the back reaction to the conformal anomaly part of the instrumentum tensor, you get that this mesh, little m is capital M times this thing going as 1 over r cubed. And now, a simple ploy is to say that, well, 1 minus x is 1 over 1 plus x, right? So if you do that, then you get a form for little m, which has this form, r cubed plus 2a squared m in the denominator, and a squared, according to the standard, if you just, because this is the order mp squared, here a squared then is the order m Planck squared. So if you just take the standard semi-classical conformal anomaly. Now, this form for the m, which then translates into a form for the whole of the metric, really has been suggested, you know, several times as a possible model for a black hole interior. And it goes back to Poisson, Israel, Hayward, more recently Frohloff has sort of revived the Hayward model. Bonanno and Reuter and Tufts and Goodsonner. Various people have postulated something either exactly this or something that's essentially this inside the horizon. And the inner horizon for this form, the reason for the factor of two is that the inner apparent horizon, when A is small compared to capital M, is close to just A. Okay. Now, the problem is, if that's all happening at the Planck scale, then we haven't really, it leaves the geometry out near the outer apparent horizon untouched, and we still have all the problems with the Hawking evaporation. So we need to enhance the back reaction. Now, I don't see any fundamental reason why the back reaction couldn't actually become much larger than predicted by the standard semi-classical approximations. Now, we need this if we want to affect the outer apparent horizon. So we need some new physics. In other words, the standard semi-classical physics doesn't work. And so my thought is that the possible source for this new physics is the entanglement between the quantum information trapped inside the black hole and the Hawking radiation, and any quantum information entangled with that outside the black hole. And predominantly the Hawking quanta outside the black hole. Now, the amount of this entanglement increases dramatically between the initial formation of the black hole and the page time. And so that suggests a way that, well, while initially the black hole semi-classical approximation may be more or less okay, by the page time, then possibly the standard semi-classical approximation has broken down and there's some steady increase in the back reaction over the page time. Now, as support for this, I appeal to the Busso covariant entry bound, which connects an entanglement von Neumann entropy and geometry. And what we'll see is that if we apply this in the deep interior of the black hole, sort of inside the inner apparent horizon, around the inner apparent horizon, and take into account this bound, that as the von Neumann entropy of the Hawking partners, which fall into minus two or either very close to or inside the inner apparent horizon, that the growing growing entropy inside the inner apparent horizon requires the area of that inner apparent horizon to increase in order to keep satisfying the Busso bound. And if you extrapolate to the page time, you find the radius of the inner apparent horizon is equal to the radius of the outer apparent horizon. Right? Now, why does this make any sense at all? Well, general relativity is not conformally invariant. So there's a possibility of quantum gravitational contributions to the trace of the energy momentum tensor beyond the standard conformal anomaly, which and so that's, I don't really have any detailed theory of that, but I think it's not totally implausible. So again, a little more detail about the Busso covariant entropy bound. We have a two-surface B, which I'm going to take to be the inner a sphere at or just outside the inner apparent horizon. You construct a null hypersurface, or which we'll call the light sheet, which is orthogonal to B and which is converging. Null generators converge going away from B. And now, as long as there are no caustics on this light sheet, the area has to then decrease. The area transected by the light sheet has to decrease. Then the bound statement of the bound is that if once the area has decreased to an A prime, And then the von Neumann entropy of the particles crossing the light sheet cannot exceed this bound. All right. Now, if we assume spherical symmetry, we can extend the light sheet all the way to article zero. Of course, that's not going to be exactly true. But most of the quantum information, one looks at the behavior of geodesics, should pile up near the inner apparent horizon, not at article zero. So then the Busseau bound then does this. And it's conjecture, since there's no proof of the Busseau bound in the presence of large quantum back reactions. So there have been some proofs, but only in basically only very semi-classical situations. All right. Now, an explicit model, then, is we assume the metric in the interior of the black hole has this Hayward form. I wrote down a couple slides ago. That is, the metric all the way to article zero. But with M and A, both functions of advanced time. Now, what this means is that there's only an ingoing energy flux, which has to be negative. So it's saying, if you take this seriously, it means the incoming energy flux cannot be described classically all the way in. Now, it's conceivable that that's okay because the wavelength of the associated with parking partners are the order of the radius all the way in. But but more, it's just a convenient sort of simple toy model because, well, you could allow for the fact that the Hawking partners propagate more outward, which is the standard picture of what the Hawking partners do, outward and, towards the outer edge of the light cone rather than the inward edge. Of course, the outer edge is also going in weather trap surfaces. And the rate of change of M is just, so the part associated with the Hawking luminosity, the time dependence of M, is maybe, the fact that this is a function of advanced time is not probably not correct, but it doesn't make a huge difference in what happens. And now Page, what's important is the rate of change of the von Neumann entropy trapped inside the inner apparent horizon. And Page has estimated, the rate of increase of the von Neumann entropy of the black hole. And if you assume the Busseau bound is saturated, then that gives you the rate increase of the area of the inner apparent horizon and gives dA squared dV is equal. Increasing, dA squared dV is positive. And there's the coefficient beta, which, so we're saying that the sum over k sub s, which is calling alpha, and that's about 7. Beta's turns out to be about 21.5, or roughly 3 alpha. So beta and alpha are of order, the same order in magnitude. And then if you then take the metric and calculate the interferometer from the Einstein equations, you get that, the TVV, which is equal to TRRR, is this expression. Sorry, this should be a DMDR here. This is a typo. DMDR. And DVR is the time derivative, and that's related to the energy flux. And then for this toy model, TRR is equal to TVV, TRV is equal to zero, and you calculate d theta from this equation. Okay, so the picture then, schematic picture is what happens then. So let's say that we form a black hole by class of a shell, which is this green line. So this is a diagram in which the diagonal lines are lines of constant advanced time, so they're inward radial geodesic trajectories. and R is constant on vertical lines. And so if you have an event horizon has to start out while you're still in Minkowski space, right before the shell. And then as the shell passes article 2M, you have an outer apparent horizon, which is the red line. And here I'm assuming that I'm looking at the early stages of evaporation when this is essentially, M is not changing very much, so this is essentially just a vertical line. And then when the shell gets to some very small radius, you develop this inner core, and there's an inner apparent horizon, which then starts expanding outward. And the arrows show the light cones at different locations. Okay. And so you can, actually you can't really see them very well, but there are sort of light brown lines going out like this. Those represent outward radial geodesics. And so you have a, so this say represents the trajectory of a Hawking quantum which goes out to infinity, and this represents the trajectory of a Hawking partner, which if it's going outward, which of course is inconsistent with the toy model, but and it comes in, and if this radius of this inner horizon is expanding, A is increasing, this is a space-like surface actually, so the outgoing delta can cross that. Of course, when it crosses, it has to go be going vertically, and then sort of will then start moving outward and once it gets inside the inner horizon. Okay, so now I'm going to, since I'm out of time, I'm going to skip this. You can take the interior solution I postulated and connect it to an exterior solution for the energy momentum tensor, sort of the first order in A squared over M squared. You can approximate things and do sort of a semi-classical approximation. now, so what happens? How does this, what's the upshot when you reach the page time? Well, now if you just take my model interior metric and let A squared increase and M decrease, and according to the formulas I gave, then you find that the outer and inner apparent horizons merge when A squared is 1627 times squared at a radius, which is 4M over 3. Now, you shouldn't take this too seriously because the semi, you know, that in that model, certainly there's no reason to believe that model once the back reaction is large, so in around the outer apparent horizon. So, so what are the possibilities? Well, sort of the simplest, in a way, the simplest and maybe one would like to be true is that the apparent horizons just merge and disappear. In other words, and that means there is no event horizon. And after that time, after the page time, there are no trap surfaces. Everything inside that was trapped inside is free to come out, go out to infinity. It's all consistent with ADS, CFT, and unitarity, and so on. Now, of course, you wouldn't expect the particle content. So if you form the star of, say, the black hole by class of a neutron star, you would not expect baryons to survive in this process. And there'd be enormous transformation of the particle content. A baryon number probably isn't conserved. And so, you know, you can't, of course, if you couldn't get all the original baryons out because there wouldn't be enough energy to get them out to infinity. But anyway, so alternative B is that the inner and outer horizons only approach each other asymptotically at infinite advanced time. And this produces asymptotically something extremely close to a degenerate horizon, like extreme Reister-Nordström or extreme Kerr, which has zero Hawking temperature. Therefore, that means that the Hawking radiation turns off. and it turns off more rapidly than just by what you expect from the talking temperature goes to zero. You're left with essentially a massive remnant, which is about half the mass, original mass of the black hole. Its Neumann entropy would be very close to or equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. The black hole would retain all of its quantum information, so there would be no unitary S matrix. And it's, you can argue about whether ADS-CFT really requires that there be a unitary S matrix. Papadonimus and Raju have argued that, it doesn't, but the existence of a Cauchy horizon, but point is there is a Cauchy horizon in the interior in this case, because at infinite advanced time, outward radiolong geodesic, which sort of asymptotically approaches this merged degenerate horizon, reaches infinite advanced time at a finite affine parameter. And therefore, that says that you can supposedly should be able to continue the space-time across the Cauchy horizon, or that there's some singularity on the Cauchy horizon. In either case, that would seem to violate quantum predictability, and therefore, maybe it's a reason not to like this alternative. Alternative C is that, well, because the Hawking partner is trapped inside, if they're propagating outward close to the inner parameter horizon, as the two horizons merge, they get sort of asymptotically, infinitesimally close to the merged horizon. And therefore, it seems perhaps possible that they could tunnel through the horizons and escape with only minimal violation of locality. And well, again, this is just speculation. In that case, the black hole would gradually shrink. As these particles tunnel through, you decrease the mass of the black hole. You also decrease its entropy. And if you somehow that works so that as the black hole shrinks, the von Neumann entropy stays equal to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, then this process might continue until the black hole shrinks down to the Planck scale and disappears, but all the quantum information getting out. So these are all speculations. A and C would be fine as far as unitarity goes, but perhaps not option B. Now, this is a side. There's why should, you know, as if I appeal to the Boussot entropy bound, but of course there really should be some physical reason for the large back reaction, not just some conjecture about entropy bounds. And a possible way of is so a possible way of thinking about it at least is the ER equal EPR conjecture of Maldacena and Susskind, which a year or so ago, which suggested that quanta which are entangled with each other, at least in the CFT in the bulk at the, you know, in the boundary of the Nanny-Sitter universe, will be connected by Einstein Rosen bridge in the bulk. Now, that, well, they actually what they talk about is Einstein Rosen between the black hole and between two black holes or something, but there have been some calculations showing fairly rigorously, I think, that by Jensen and Karsh, which of a particular model for the CFT, and actually demonstrating that there is actually an Einstein-Rosen bridge in the bulk. Now, this is not the same as what I want to do, which is have an Einstein-Rosen bridge between a Hawking partner in the interior of the black hole and Hawking quantum far outside the black hole. But if the ER equal EPR is more general in that sense, then you have all these microscopic isolated ridges, and once they get to sort of one per unit Hawking unit, Planck area of the horizon, then I'm saying there's a big back reaction. In a very hand-waving way, I think that's perhaps not implausible if all any of this makes sense. Okay, and this is just, well, this is a Penrose diagram of alternative A, so it looks just like Minkowski space, right? You have an unsingular origin. You have the green line, again, is the collapsing shell. And then you have this region of trapped surfaces, but no event horizon. So it comes out near this. Now, here is sort of along this arrow is all the Hawking radiation. And then you have the Hawking partners coming out here. And then above here, you just have Minkowski space. So, and of course, here you just have Minkowski space. So whether this, so this is, these Penrose diagrams can hide an enormous amount of physics because you have to remember there are extreme conformal transformations involved in producing a Penrose diagram. So in terms of how the radius behaves, of course, in the trap case, the radius is actually decreasing, right, along this arrow until you get out of the trap surface region. And all this is a very, very small radii. Anyway, so final thoughts. So I argue that these, if you look at the semi-classical results for the effective measurement tensor for a large social black hole, it lends absolutely no support to any of the ways that people postulated of getting information out of the black hole. That there are macroscopic quantum correlations. Hawking radiation is not produced within a Planck microwave horizon. It's produced over this whole region around the horizon, extending out to the potential barrier outside the black hole. And then it results from the stretching of modes of the unruh vacuum. It's not a tunneling process. A realistic black hole should not be viewed as a thermal state at the Hawking temperature, which a lot of people have done. Because, at least in my picture, the von Neumann entropy of the black hole is, I think, I can argue very strongly that it's tiny compared to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy at times after, not too long after the formation of the black hole. And it's only at the page time where the two can become comparable. I mean, you might possibly think of the black hole as being some sort of thermal state. There's no fast scrambling, as I've argued. Distributing energy uniformly over an exponential of that Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of quantum states. So no more than you just take some box in Minkowski space, right? You can't say that ignorance of what's inside the box says that you know that there's a maximum entropy inside the box, right? In other words, you have to look at the vacuum state and so on. So anyway, what I argue then is the black hole is really basically a classical concept. It's saying that you have, it only makes sense if you have a quasi-classical space-time, something that can be described by a metric. And which has, so the black hole is a region of that space-time which has certain properties like trapped surfaces. You can have quantum fields living in that space-time, and they can modify the geometry. Now, as long as the quantum fluctuations are very small, or as long as, even if the back reaction is big, if the back reaction is due to a huge number of individual quanta, then I think it's not unreasonable that this quasi-classical picture can make sense. And now, if you consider a fundamental theory of quantum gravity, that may include many of these exotic configurations that people have postulated, like thermalized black holes, like black holes with firewalls, like fuzzballs, and so on. These may all be, in some sense, states of the fundamental theory, but what I argue is that those states are not the result of quantum evolution from the reasonable initial conditions for our universe. And it's only at the page time maybe some of these things can come into play. And so, in that sense, I would argue that what I propose then in this talk is the least radical way of resolving the information paradox. It's not requiring any really fundamental new physics. No. Okay, well, thanks. So, any questions?
Yeah, of the three scenarios that you proposed at the end, A, B, and C, it would seem that A is the most appealing, it's the simplest. I think it can be ruled out on the basis of energy conservation. For energy to be conserved so that there is not more than the initial mass that gets radiated away to infinity, the purification phase, you can show, should be slow. Unfortunately, in the models where the inner and the outer horizon merge, all the geodesics that get trapped get focused near the inner horizon, and when they come out all at once, and so purification is very fast. And so this clashes with the requirement that purification is slow.
So yeah, that could be a problem.
Well, one can derive a lower bound on the purification time under the assumption of energy conservation, and it's at least m cubed. It must take at least m cubed time in Planck units for purification to take place. And that's way too long for these models up here.
Yeah, so, well, it could be, for model C, it could still be consistent.
Yeah, I was talking about yeah.
But, no, I agree. I haven't studied that argument carefully, so I can't really comment whether I believe it or not, but it could be a fatal.
I'm happy to discuss more details, but it's not hard, it's easy to see.
From my understanding, isn't it just like another proposal similar to complementary? Like, instead of a straight horizon, now you have the apparent horizon to do the same role. Aren't you storing everything information there just to?
Well, it's the inner apparent horizon.
Yeah, but still you are forming a geometry.
So, well, depends how general you want a complementarity to be. You have to store the information somewhere, but when I argue storing it at the outer apparent horizon seems very implausible to me because the geodesics diverge away from the outer apparent horizon. They converge toward the inner apparent horizon. So that's why I said that in order to store information on the outer apparent horizon, you need to have very short wavelength, very high energy particles. And because a particle propagating the outer apparent horizon suffers an enormous redshift. And once its energy is down to the point that its wavelength is the order of m, right, then it's gone, right?
So it goes on.
But so I mean, you have to store the quantum information somewhere. I think it's more plausible that it's this inner apparent horizon than the outer apparent horizon.
Let me just ask if I understand the picture correctly. So the symmetric coefficient, which you call capital A, basically we did the suggestion with this one minus x is one over one over one plus x strict is that its shape is kind of like a Hadron radius. It's like first it goes positive, then it has two zeros.
So
these two zeros mark the
yeah. So a is one at the origin. It is zero at the inner parameterizing. And then it's very large and negative in the region of trapped surfaces. And it goes back through zero at the outer parameterizing and goes to one at infinity.
And the difference between option A and option scenario A and scenario B is whether that zero, whether that negative region disappears altogether or whether it remains ultimately tangent.
Right, so whether whether the negative region disappears or whether it sort of shrinks down to some infinitesimal size, in double R.
Becomes tangent to zero.
And so the peak of A, if A has a minimum of zero, that's when you have a degenerate horizon.
Have a lot of entanglement gravity changes. So if I assume I make a lot of entangled photon pairs, I then always send one of them at one place to make a black hole, but they are entangled with all the other pairs just
right.
Outside, then you would say that the black hole would look different than the one built from ordinary matter.
So you could imagine forming a black hole, especially from Hawking quanta.
some entangled photon pairs.
In which case you start out right away, essentially at the page time, you have a very large number of quanta forming the black hole, as opposed to some more ordinary astrophysical process. And I think that's fine. It just means that you sort of start off at the end stage instead of. So then, and I think this my scenario is, Steve Hawking wrote a paper early. Put out a paper early this year, which he argued that time reversal invariance means that you can't have an event horizon. And I think my model is consistent with his picture, but I think you can argue that you could do the time reverse of this scenario. It would seem very strange from the point of view of how one normally thinks what would be likely to happen, but it's because you would have to form the black hole by all these sort of Hawking partner quanta coming in from infinity, forming the black hole, and then have the time reverse of then the Hawking quanta coming in from infinity. And canceling out the Hawking radiation that wouldn't normally be at the outer parent horizon. Gradually increasing the mass of the black hole, and then somehow the stuff inside gets processed from these Hawking particle quanta into, say, baryons and ordinary matter, comes out in the time reverse of the collapse. So I don't know, I think that's a good.
So we're about to go to lunch, and also there's dinner at 6:30 again if you're interested to join in the Beast Room. Mateo, I'm looking at you.
Okay, sure.
All right.
We'll come here.
Yep. Thanks.